Professor Tim Hitchcock, who is Professor of 18th Century History at the University of Hertfordshire. As well as being a leading historian of early modern London poverty and gender, he's co-director with Robert Shoemaker of the online edition of the Old Bailey Sessions Proceedings, which is funded by the AHRC and the New Opportunities Fund. And his title today is Dissemination and Promotion of an Online Resource. Tim.
Good afternoon. I've been asked to speak on the theme of dissemination and promotion, and I suspect I received that invitation precisely because the website I helped to create has garnered a lot of attention. It's won the Art Prize for Accessibility and been featured in newspapers and on the radio and on television, pretty much across the English-speaking world. We, on average, have around 4,000 visits a day with about 20,000 page impressions. The majority of those visitors are family historians and the general public. But these numbers also include a lot of undergraduates and postgraduates and professional academics, many of whom have come to rely on the site as a fast way of collecting information on social life and crime in the 18th century. If you want the perfect example of somebody picking their nose or reading by candlelight, a few quick searches on the website will find it. We have historical linguists and literary scholars, as well as historians and museum curators, actively using this material and modifying their scholarly practice in response to its availability. In terms of public and academic impact, the site seems to have worked. And in terms of publicity, we did all the things we could think of to encourage that. We issued regular press releases to both national and local press. We created a two-fold flyer advertising the site, which we distributed nationally, and a colorful A3 poster. We organized an international conference, and in the spirit of boosterism, we declared the establishment of a new sort of history, a new history from below. We spent hours talking to journalists and making sure they were providing with the best stories and the most gruesome details. And we traipsed from radio station to radio station, desperately trying to maintain our enthusiasm. I stayed up late to answer questions from Sheila and Alice Springs and got up early to do the same for Joe in Arkansas. In other words, we worked hard at dissemination. But in terms of group practice for other sites, I don't think that these obvious bits of self-promotion are really the point. Nor do I think that they explain the level of usage that we've been able to attract. Instead, the site's been successful because of what it provides and how that material is presented. It was created, in the first instance, for a popular and an academic audience and presented with the needs of both of those audiences very much to the fore. The site itself, allows both keyword and structured searching of around 25 million words of text. And we've now been given funding to post another 70 million words of 19th century text and a further 25 million words of 18th century manuscript material. So we'll have about a billion and a third words, but it's only an American billion, so it's not a lot. But the site includes felony trials held at the Old Bailey in London between 1674 and 1834. It also includes digital versions of contemporary maps and upon which the location of trials can be located. So, for example, we can go from that trial to the place where the crime took place, all that sort of thing. It works. It also includes a comprehensive list of associated manuscripts and printed material relating to each of the 100,000 trials involved. There are some 40,000 words of explanatory text. Sorry, this doesn't relate to the that point, but never mind. A long-winded beware of dangerous evidence sign crafted to catch the attention of all the major user groups who regularly visit the site. There's a statistical facility allowing users to generate graphs and tables with a wide range of structured information. And finally, because we assume that most users will be rightly suspicious of our transcription, we provide an image of the original page so that everyone and their first-year undergraduate can check whether our reading was correct. Now, some of the reasons the site has proved to be a success are to do with the source. It was simply right for digitization. The Old Bailey proceedings had a substantial fan base throughout the English-speaking world long before the internet was invented. Copies on microfilm have been used by undergraduates and family historians in North America and Australia as a basis for their research for a generation. The source is also a self-contained and comprehensive series of documents that can claim authority, precisely because it is self-contained. Many historical websites choose to post a selection of documents from a larger pool, presumably in the hope of whetting the appetite of potential users. In the process, however, they leave hungry and unsatisfied almost everyone. Equally, the content of the proceedings couldn't have been better. All the titillation of a tabloid is there, which, at the very least, makes the site easy to sell to your average journalist. But even together, I don't believe that any of those factors, although important, actually explain the site's success. Instead, I think that this success is primarily rooted in the mind-numbing, intellectually vacuous process of application that we were actually forced to go through by the funding body who originally put up the initial money. The project started as a New Opportunities Fund application. The NOF was a lottery-funded program designed to encourage the digitization of cultural materials. It was also the most irritating bit of civil service hard work I have ever encountered. It was Kafka for the digital age. The original idea for the site was a simple, no-frills system. But once we began to work through the demands of the NOF, our limited academic aspirations did not survive. By the end of a year-long process, we had generated a two-volume application running to over 140 pages and including a detailed three-year business plan. In my estimation, the application alone, entirely separate from creating the site, was the equivalent of writing a short book. Within it were Gantt charts and work packages, risk assessments, technical assessments, and IPR agreements. But the most important bit were the hundreds of letters back and forth with almost every family history and local history group in the country. Tens of teachers at A-level in Key Stage 3, academics and publishers, ream after ream of feedback. What we were forced to do by the application process was to confront who we were actually doing this job of work for, and in the process to consider what each of those users really needed. In many respects, we were forced to assess audience and demand in ways that an academic author or of a published book would never have to. Professor Shoemaker and I are really very old-fashioned academic historians. We didn't know what school students wanted or what you could expect from family historians. But the process of consultation had the effect of forcing us to confront the grimy-fingered users who populate our schools, always more keen to look up a swear word than to confront historical information. And the occasionally computer-shy family historian, obsessively seeking out every last detail of some excitingly criminal black sheep. In other words, the hard labor that went into getting the money to implement this project led directly to our building into the site, provision for the fullest range of users. It was designed and funded to be a popular site, and therefore it became one. There are detailed help notes for use by teachers and clear background material on the history of the proceedings and of 18th century London. I was forced to learn how to write paragraphs that had no more than 40 words in them, much to my irritation. Detailed advice on searching for names and crimes and places was provided, as is the opportunity to post feedback and examples of good practice. It took us 6 months of full-time work to write up the documentation, while the schools element of the site was written by an expert in the history and history teaching in schools, Peter Messina, because we knew we just did not have the experience to do a good job on that bit. The fact that the Old Bailey proceedings are full of sex and drugs, violence and drama helped. But the important thing about our experience is that we were forced to create the equivalent of a popular scholarly book, to create a scholarly resource explicitly justified by its appeal to a wider public. In the process, we were forced to confront and overcome, in ways that most of us never do, all the questions and problems normally faced by a publisher. Different websites are directed at very different audiences, and we need to tailor the text we post for the specific audience intended, and to judge the success of a site, not by the number of visits it receives, but by the impact it has on its intended audience. What I think our experience with the Old Bailey has left me with is a huge frustration that as we move from the book to the internet, we seem to have forgotten all the hard lessons learned in 500 years of publishing history. There was a reason why some books are academic and some are trade, why some are read on the beach in Ibiza and others in the bowels of Senate House. An academic text, say an edited edition produced by a record society of an 18th century manuscript, is judged by the series it's in and trusted accordingly. More prosaically, as a reader, you look at the typeface,
You weigh it up. You look at the title page and the colophon, scan the index, and carefully weigh up the balance between white space and text. At least metaphorically, you judge a book by its cover. And you don't find it wanting because the print run was 500 copies, or because it has only been read by a few hands full of people. Its value lies in the scholarship that it contains, which in turn has been guaranteed by the publisher, and which is proclaimed on every page by the format. It is a product designed to last perhaps 100 years and to influence 5 generations of scholars. Just because that same manuscript has been posted on the internet, just because it has escaped the shelves of the university library, does not actually change any of that. The internet sites with the greatest number of users are vending porn and games and music. If you want large numbers of users, then post Paris Hilton sexcapades. What you're looking for, however, is a way of reaching the academic community, then you have to target that community. For books, there is a whole profession dedicated to making sure that what we write reaches the correct group of readers. Publishers and editors, publicity departments, and peer reviewers spend their time ensuring that a monograph on 16th century local government looks like a monograph on 16th century local government and not like detective fiction. In relation to the internet, the whole publishing apparatus has been eliminated. As simple-minded academics with little experience, we have been left to get on with the complex process of publishing in a new form. And it's little wonder that, for the most part, people get it wrong. The best academic practice on the internet is wonderful. If you look at sites like the Royal Historical Society's Bibliography of British History, you find sites with a clear sense of who the users are likely to be and all the tools that those users need to quickly generate the information required. They are true to the original source, but they add value to it. They are also updated and improved versions of resources that justify publication anyway, and whose justification for publication, even in a commercial context, was beyond doubt. There are lots of reasons to post historical material on the internet, but the internet itself does not change the hard lessons learned over hundreds of years of the publishing industry. A book that would warrant a print run of 500 is not going to appeal to the fans of online gambling just because it's available. The challenge, it seems to me, for those creating new resources is to build a set of practices in relation to dissemination and publicity that create new systems of quality control, production, and distribution. Ironically, the very democratic nature of the web challenges us to recreate the hoops and hurdles of academic publishing.